the love of God, get me out of here!
You cannot pass! I will have my freedom!
Colonel Shepard! Taylor, help me!
Dr. Beckett! Can you hear me? Dr. Beckett! Hang on, Carson. We're nearly there.
I'm sorry I can't be more help, love. This is hardly a proper welcome to Atlantis.
Nonsense, Dr. Beckett. It's the perfect welcome. I've always preferred to be thrown in at the deep end.
I'm afraid we don't really have a shallow end out here.
No, I suppose you don't. You gave us quite a fright today.
Did I? I feel like a right numpty, to be honest. I can't remember a thing about it.
Which, as I'm sure you know, is a very common reaction to trauma. It's perfectly normal.
Aye, so it is. But right now it doesn't feel normal, I remember being afraid, but the rest is just a blank. I don't even know how I hurt my leg.
And that's normal too. You fell, Doctor, during the rescue.
Resulting in a tibial shaft fracture, aye. But rescue from what? I don't know what happened to me.
There'll be plenty of time for that later, when you're ready to remember. In the meantime, rest. Heal.
I thought there'd be more pain. My patients always complained of more pain.
Then you're either very brave or very lucky. There's not much displacement or angulation, so you'll be in a cast for a few weeks and right as rain in no time. Meanwhile, rest, Doctor. I'll take care of everything.
Perhaps I should talk to Dr. Heitmeier. Early intervention in post-traumatic stress can...
No. Not yet. It's too soon. Rest now, Carson. Everything's going to be just fine.
And that's how it started, with gentle words of encouragement. I thought I was safe. I thought we all were, inside the walls of Atlantis. How could I know that the nightmare had already begun? They say doctors make the worst patients, which is probably true. They also say, physician, heal thyself. To that end, and contrary to Dr. Gilbert's advice, I started to keep a diary. It's something I often advise my patients to do after a traumatic incident, even one they can't remember, because it helps to sort out the jumble of nonsense we all keep inside our heads. It helps us to sort out the fact from fiction, truth from tricks of the mind. Now, paranoia is a well-documented symptom of post-traumatic stress, and so even as I began to notice the strange things happening around me, I was aware that it could all have been an aspect of my trauma. A fiction, in other words, like Marley's ghost. Nevertheless, I made note of it all, meticulously scratching times and dates in that little diary. Strange, looking back, that even then I'd known to keep it a secret, to keep it hidden from her.
Sergeant Thompson. They found him out on the West Pier this morning.
What's wrong with him?
The same. Same as the others.
Sitting there in my bed, I could see it all. 4 patients, inexplicably unconscious, with no evidence of trauma. Others slumped on chairs and beds, listless and anemic. Strangest of all, though, no one consulted me, not a single doctor or nurse. I asked Dr. Gilbert about it, but she just smiled, that soothing smile of hers.
You should be resting, Carson.
I can look at a chart while I'm sitting here, love. Now, come on, hand it over.
It's a viral infection, that's all. Fatigue, low blood pressure, flu-like symptoms.
A virus? You see, that in itself was suspicious, but at the point I didn't know what to make of it. And in truth, I didn't trust myself. My mind had wiped out a large chunk of my memory. How could I trust it with anything else? And so I asked her the obvious question. If it's a virus, why aren't these patients being isolated?
We've surmised that it's a foodborne virus, Dr. Beckett. It originated on M3R-281 and was brought back by Colonel Shepard's team.
Foodborne?
Doctor, with all due respect, you need to trust me to do my job until you're well enough to return to duty. It's only been 2 days.
Aye, so it has. But 2 days since what? And if it was a foodborne virus, why were more and more people getting sick? Why were they deteriorating, lapsing into unconsciousness, slipping into comas? The diagnosis made no sense, and I could tell that Dr. Gilbert didn't want me to pursue the matter. Perhaps I should have done. Perhaps if I pressed her further, the truth would have emerged sooner. But you have to remember how I felt, still bruised from the mission. Aye, but more than that, still shaken, still unsure that I wasn't inventing a grandiose paranoid delusion. And so I decided to investigate for myself, to find the answers I felt Dr. Gilbert wasn't giving me. That night, I got out of bed. I chose my time well, waiting for Dr. Gilbert to leave and making sure no one else was paying any attention. Then, when it was quiet, at the deadest part of the night, I grabbed the crutches by my bed and got up. It's funny because I remember thinking it was lucky the crutches were even there. Dr. Gilbert had forbidden me to get up, and I wondered who'd left them there for me. With some difficulty, I made it out of the bed and across the infirmary to Lieutenant Todd's bed. A young man with a shock of thick black hair, Lieutenant Todd was one of the most popular members of the expedition. His dark eyes had a ready twinkle, but right now they were closed with his face milky. I glanced at his chart, not sure what I should find there. Now let's see, patients presenting with hypotension, the condition appears progressive, beginning with faintness, listlessness, moving on to coma and potential organ failure. Blood tests reveal now, wait, that can't be right. What I saw there disturbed me more than I could articulate. I felt my mouth go dry and a cold lump settle in the pit of my stomach. Lad, if I didn't know better, I'd say you've been lunch for a wraith. But there's no entry wound, no premature aging. Uneasily, I moved on to the next bed and flipped through the chart. Sergeant Wood, same symptoms. Captain Crane, same again. All of them, everyone in the infirmary looked as though they'd been fed on. Not enough to kill, mind you, just a little. But all the primary indicators were absent. No marks on the chest, no aging. A virus indeed. I've never seen any virus like that. I froze. Because I knew instinctively that it was Dr. Gilbert. I was surprised she'd returned so soon, but of course, I know now that she had never left. That she was probably watching me all along. But then I had no idea about any of that. And so I hurried quickly back to bed. I kept my eyes open though, just enough to watch as she walked past. She stopped at each bed as she should, and then left. Totally normal behaviour, I might have thought, except I found something else that night. Something I don't think I was expected to find so soon. Something that did more to undermine the notion that these patients were suffering from a foodborne virus than anything else. I found patient zero. Well, that is, I found a room with a sign on the door that said patient zero. A locked isolation room that my pass wouldn't open. My pass. Head of medicine on Atlantis. It was that, I think, that really made me determined to find out the truth about what was going on. And to get answers, I knew I need to go to the top. It's funny looking back that I thought it would be so simple. I thought I could circumvent Gilbert and whatever game she was playing and appeal straight to Dr. Weir herself. I should have guessed it wouldn't be that easy. I woke up early, determined to see Dr. Weir first thing. I wanted her to explain why my pass was invalid, why I wasn't being consulted about the treatment of the sickness. I wanted her to explain what had happened to me, what I had forgotten.
Dr. Weir!
Stay back. They know what they're doing. God.
What happened?
They found her in her quarters this morning. She must have been taken ill during the night.
With this so-called virus?
So-called virus?
She gave me a look then, hard and suspicious. And I remember it because it seemed so cold, so inhuman. It's right there that I should have guessed what was happening. I should have known that this was no coincidence. And perhaps on some level I did. But I still wasn't ready to accept the truth. I was still clinging to the idea that there was an innocuous explanation. Still hoping, perhaps, that Dr. Gilbert had just made a mistake. I know now that it was a foolish hope, a dangerous hope. But with Dr. Weir succumbing to the sickness, I felt it was the only hope I had. I brooded on that all night. My leg was itching beneath the plaster. I couldn't sleep. I thought it was odd. I remember that my leg didn't hurt, that I felt no ill effects from the break, but I didn't understand until much later why it was. Sometimes I think, if I'd only been paying more attention to those little details, things might not have gotten so out of hand. But at the time, my real concern was for Dr. Weir. Hello, Lisbeth. How are you feeling? A wee bit better, I hope. As I sat with Elizabeth, giving her what comfort I could and drawing some for myself, the door opened, and in walked Colonel Shepherd. Was I relieved to see him? He didn't look at me, though. Just came and sat on the other side of the bed. I thought it was a little strange, but I'm not one to judge. And at the time, I think I was still wary because I didn't know what happened on the mission. I didn't know how I'd been injured, and I was afraid that I'd done something wrong, that perhaps I'd endangered the whole team. After all, Dr. Gilbert had said I needed rescuing. So I held back. I said nothing, but after a while, Colonel Shepherd spoke. "I'm sorry," he said quietly. "Elizabeth, I'm sorry, but I don't know what to do. Everyone's falling sick and there's no explanation, no cure, and now you." He went silent then, arms folded across his chest, staring out in nothing in particular. With a sigh, he said, "Even Atlantis doesn't know what to do. Our quarantine defences have been triggered. There's nothing in the database to help us. Rodney and Zelenka are working around the clock, but they've got nothing," he frowned, running a hand through his hair. After a moment, he sat forward and a low voice said, "Between you and me, Elizabeth, I'm not certain this is a medical emergency at all. I don't know what it is, but I'm going to talk to Taylor, I think. I don't know what I think yet." Now, this was a revelation. If Atlantis' quarantine system hadn't been triggered, then I was right. Whatever was causing the sickness was not a virus. Drawing closer, still mindful of not intruding, I said, "Excuse me, Colonel Shepherd, but have you not had any backup from Stargate Medical? Dr. Lam has..." But to my surprise, Shepherd completely ignored me. He stood up, his attention fixed only on Dr. Weir, and said, "Hang in there, Elizabeth," before turning quickly and striding from the room. I watched him go in surprise, feeling hurt, and I wondered if he'd blame me for what was happening. After Shepherd left, I sat for a while with Elizabeth, thinking about what had just happened. But the infirmary felt too quiet. I was too lonely among the sleeping patients who would not wake. So I decided to get out and find some company. And in Atlantis, company means the cafeteria. It was slow going, working my way on crutches down the long corridors. And it's funny because I remember feeling like I was out of sync with everyone bustling past me, as if we couldn't quite connect. And I put that down to how slow I was walking. Of course, that wasn't it at all, but I didn't know that then. Still, one of the advantages of moving so slowly was that I paid a bit more attention. If I'd been racing along at my usual clip, I might not have seen Taylor. She was sitting with her back to me on one of Atlantis's many balconies, gazing out over the night dark seas. She was exactly the person I wanted to talk to. But when I got onto the balcony, I saw that she was deep in meditation. It would have been rude to interrupt her, so I backed away, but I was rather clumsy on the crutches, and she must have heard a noise because she opened her eyes and stared right at me in astonishment. "Dr. Beckett," she said, as if she couldn't believe I was standing there on the balcony with her. "I love," I replied, but I was embarrassed at disturbing her, so I quickly made an excuse to leave. "Don't worry yourself," I said, "I'm just off to get a wee cup of tea." I left hurriedly, but I remember I was surprised at her reaction. Something felt off, not quite right about the way she was staring at me. I think deep down, I probably knew that she was afraid. I just didn't want to know why. I was still pondering Taylor's strange reaction as I made my way to the cafeteria. And perhaps it was because my mind was so preoccupied, so unfocused on what was around me, that I first saw it. I only glimpsed it from the corner of my eye, a shadow flitting around a corner. And I wasn't even sure it was real. I was still mindful of the effects of the post-traumatic stress, and I knew my mind could be playing tricks on me. But even so, I couldn't just ignore it. Something about it raised a chill down the length of my spine. And so, moving as fast as I could, I followed it around the corner, and there it was. Vaguely human-shaped, yet constantly shifting. It floated a couple of feet above the floor, drifting to the left and right as it made its way down the corridor. Somehow, I knew it was looking for something, like an animal following a scent. My heart was racing by now as I trailed it through Atlantis, but the thing was moving fast and I was slow and awkward on crutches, so I only managed to follow it as far as the city's residential quarters before it disappeared. I hurried back to the infirmary, ready to raise the alarm, but when I got there, I found Dr. Gilbert waiting for me.
"What on earth are you doing out of bed?"
"Listen, there's something in the city. I don't know how to describe it. A shadow.
A shadow?
I followed it to the residential quarters. We need to...
Dr. Beckett.
We need to raise the alarm. We need to...
Carson, listen to yourself. A shadow? It's the middle of the night. Atlantis is full of shadows.
Not like this one.
You're familiar with waking dreams. Night terrors. As a symptom of post-traumatic stress disorders.
I wasn't dreaming.
Weren't you, Carson? I've been here all night. Do you really think I'd let you get up and start wandering the corridors in your condition? Do you think any of your staff would have? Now get back into bed. I'll give you something to help you sleep.
Now, you have to understand how confused I was at this point, how uncertain of everything. I had this looming hole in my memories. I knew I'd been hurt, but I had no idea how. I knew something had gone wrong, but I didn't know what. And no one was talking to me. No one but Gilbert. I trusted her, I suppose, because I had no one else. So I did as she said, and when I looked around the infirmary, I realised there were nurses everywhere, quietly going about their business. And I knew none of them would have let me leave the infirmary alone. I thought perhaps she was right, that my mind was still reeling from the trauma I couldn't remember. And that's why I swallowed the pills she gave me, why I let myself drift back to sleep. For those few moments, I let myself believe that was all a bad dream. The next day I woke up late, hungover from the temazepam. My mind was blurred, my eyes gritty, and it took a moment before I realised who lay in the bed opposite mine. Colonel Shepherd.
He was brought in last night. Someone found him unconscious in his quarters.
Sleeping sickness?
Yes. I'm sorry.
Dredging through the events of last night, I remembered the shadow I'd seen in the crew quarters. Coincidence? Or paranoia? Was it even real? My memory was foggy, indistinct. To have a mind full of holes as broken as the bone in my leg, I found myself wondering if this was madness. Once my head had cleared, I got myself out of bed. Looking back, it seems strange that I didn't question when no one had stopped me from getting up. But I suppose everyone was so busy in the infirmary that I thought they just didn't notice. And that was fine by me. I didn't want to be noticed. Over on my desk, I saw a pile of notes, as if someone had been working there. And when I walked over, I saw the familiar scrawl of Rodney's handwriting across the pages. They were his notes, his research into the sickness. Curious, I began to read. Now, no matter how big of a pain in the neck he can be, I've always had tremendous respect for Rodney McKay. But his thesis about the cause of the disease was frankly nonsense. Stress? Mass hysteria? Just because you can't see the cause of the malady doesn't mean there's no cause to be found. I decided I had to talk to him. I wasn't sure whether to mention the strange spectre I'd seen, because Rodney is the last person to believe something so fanciful, and I was feeling uncertain enough about it already. The last thing I needed were his acerbic comments on the subject, but I knew he was barking up the wrong tree with his theories, and I felt it was my duty to put him right. Rodney can usually be found in one of two places, his lab or the cafeteria. That day, he was in the cafeteria, alone. The place was mostly empty because it was after the breakfast rush and before lunch, and Rodney seemed to have chosen a table as far away as possible from the few people eating there. He sat staring morosely into his coffee, stuffing a donut into his mouth. From that, I deduced that his research was not going well. The problem is, I said, easing myself down into a chair opposite, the problem is that you're approaching this from entirely the wrong perspective. Rodney didn't respond. In fact, he sat in a persistent stony silence. Look, I said, let me help you. Despite what Dr. Gilbert thinks, I believe we can rule out any kind of viral infection because... Rodney sighed heavily, tapping his fingers on the table in an irritating staccato. The victims appear entirely random, he muttered into his coffee. He picked up a spoon and began to stir thoughtfully. No evidence of contagion? Exactly, I replied, pleased that we were thinking along the same lines. Pleased, in fact, that he was talking to me at all after my encounters with Colonel Shepherd and Taylor. Now, if it's not a contagion, then we need to look at other causes. Still hesitant to mention the strange shadow I'd seen, I chose to approach the subject from a more obtuse angle. Have you considered, I said, the possibility that there might be some kind of malevolent... Roddy jumped to his feet. Of course, he exclaimed, smacking his forehead in irritation. I can't believe I didn't think of it before. And with that, he dashed off without a by your leave, let alone a thank you for your thoughts, Dr. Beckett. It was typical Roddy McKay. Or so I thought. It took me a while to get back to the infirmary, but I remember feeling pleased that I had talked to Rodney. I don't think by that point I was entirely convinced by Gilbert's insistence that I was suffering from paranoid delusions. I wasn't entirely convinced I wasn't either, but I was glad to have put Rodney on what I thought was the right path. I was certain that if there were any connection between the strange shadow and the sickness affecting the base, he would find it. Not that I would ever tell him that, of course. To my surprise, when I reached the infirmary, I found Taylor there. She wasn't sick, thank God. She was simply sitting on an empty bed, cross-legged in a deep meditation. I thought it was a trifle strange, but the lass has some odd ways, and I had no desire to disturb her. I decided to get back to bed before Dr. Gilbert noticed I was gone. But as I was creeping past Taylor, not an easy task on crutches, I might tell you, she opened her eyes and looked right at me. "Dr. Beckett?" she asked, strangely hesitant. "Yes, love," I said. "I hope I didn't." She gave me no time to finish before bursting out with, "I am very happy to see you, Carson." I was a little taken aback by her vehemence, but I smiled and said, "Aye, well, it's always a pleasure to see you too, love. Now, what can I..." She slid down from the bed, crossing the room quickly. "You must help us, Carson." I sighed and indicated my plastered leg. "I'm doing what I can," I assured her, "and so is Dr. Gilbert. She..." "No," Taylor said. "Carson, you must help us. You must come back. Come back to us, please." If I'm being honest, I thought she was being a wee bit daft. After all, I'd only spent a few days in the infirmary, but I'd not the heart to say as much to Taylor. "Look, love," I began. But then she reached out, touched my hand, and suddenly I was falling. Down and down I fell into a vast emptiness, a terrifying wasteland. Nothing as far as the eye could see in any direction. Nothing but grey rock and sand, battered by a howling wind that tore ceaselessly across the vast, lifeless desert. It was a place of death, of terrible hunger and terrible thirst. And it was empty, so crushingly empty, I could scarcely draw breath. As if from a distance I heard myself whimpering. "No, no.
Dr. Beckett?
Oh God, no. Not again.
Dr. Beckett, can you hear me?
Help me, for the love of God, get me out of here. Colonel Shepherd, Taylor, please!
Dr. Beckett."
I felt a hand on my arm, warm and real, living. Slowly I opened my eyes and...
"There now. It's all right."
I was back in the infirmary, in my bed. But the dread of that terrible emptiness lingered, and I found myself shaking. Dr. Gilbert was by my side, her face a picture of concern as she took my hand. Taylor was nowhere to be seen.
"Rest for a moment, Carson. That was difficult."
"What? What was that?"
"What do you think it was?"
"I don't know." And then suddenly, in some clinical part of my mind that was still more doctor than patient, I understood. And the truth was more terrifying than anything else. It was a flashback.
"A memory. Yes."
"But of what? What was that place? What happened to me?"
"Come, Dr. Beckett. Let me show you."
Dr. Gilbert held out her hand, helping me from the bed. Her face was calm, but I remember noticing an excitement in her eyes. That's what I thought it was anyway. But looking back, it was probably something else entirely. We stopped outside the isolation room marked Patient Zero. And looking back at that moment, I realised it was then that I stopped believing any of this was normal. My memory loss, the sickness, the shadow. I glanced over at Dr. Gilbert, and she smiled, a little sadly, and nodded towards the door. In great trepidation, I pushed it open and stepped into the small room beyond. What I saw there fixed me to the floor in shock. I remember that moment vividly, as if it were a photograph I've studied for years, examining every detail until even the lines on people's faces are familiar. I was looking down at a bed on which a man lay, a man who looked identical to myself. He was pale, clearly very sick, and was being kept alive by the forest of machines surrounding him. I remember thinking, Who is he? I don't understand. What is this? A clone or...
It's you, Carson. This is you. Everything that's happened over the past 3 days, all the confusion, the holes in your memory, they can all be explained.
How? I don't understand. How can this be me?
Think back, Carson. Think back to the mission. Do you remember? That's where it all began.
Colonel Shepard! Taylor! Do you read me? Where are you? Bloody, what have you done? It's opening! I'm running now, through dark, empty corridors, heart pounding in terror. Something grabs me. Hard, bony fingers are snatching at my clothes, dragging me along. But I can't see anything. There's no one there. Help me! Help me, Colonel Shepard! Help me! Suddenly I see it, glistening in the darkness, an oil slick of shifting light. No! No! There are hands everywhere now, grasping, tugging, hauling me closer. Shadows flit before my eyes, wisp of wretched darkness dragging me closer, closer to that dreadful light. Colonel Shepard, help me! And then I touch it. It's like a veil of ice slick and deathly cold. It is terror made manifest. It's horror. It's death. It's the end of all things. No, God! Please, no! I'm thrust into a vast, despairing wilderness. Desolate, ravaged by hunger, and I know now that I'm in hell. But then through the howling wind, I hear voices. Colonel Shepard, Taylor, McKay, they're all calling me, screaming my name. I'm here! I scream back. I'm here! I'm here! And then... suddenly, I'm back in Atlantis. I can feel the straps tight about my arms and legs as I'm raced towards the infirmary. There are blurred faces and indistinct voices. I think I hear Rodney. And then there's a jab in the back of my hand and darkness falls like night. Oh, dear God. Oh, God.
Easy now. Sit down.
I remember there were fingers pulling me, some kind of portal and death. And tell me what happened to me.
Look about you, Dr. Beckett. You can see for yourself.
Remembering that moment, as I looked about the sterile room at the man she said was me, I can still feel the strange bite of terror. It was as if understanding flooded me in an instant. There was no gradual realization of the truth, no gentle dawn. It was just that one moment I didn't understand, and the next I did. I looked at the monitors attached to his body, at the leads and wires running to the machines behind him, and I knew there was nothing there. No brain activity, nothing. So I'm dead then?
In the physical form, yes.
But I was just talking to Taylor and to Rodney.
Were you? You've been here, in this room, for 3 days, Carson. Only your spirit can wander these corridors now. If you spoke to them, they didn't hear you.
No, oh no. This isn't true. This is a delusion, a fantasy. I'm not dead. You're nothing more than a figment of my imagination, a product of my trauma. Something happened. I broke my leg and... perhaps she glanced down at my leg then. I can't remember. But I do know that I looked down horrified to find the plaster gone and my leg whole and healed. No, not healed, because of course it had never been broken at all.
Sometimes the mind is not ready to accept the truth, Carson. It clings to a lie, to a fantasy, in order to protect itself.
I looked over again at the body on the bed, kept alive by machines. Dear God, I'm dead.
But it's not the end of the story.
It looks bloody final to me.
Your body is failing, yes, but your spirit is ready to move on. I'm here to guide you, to show you the way back.
With that, she lifted her hand, and from thin air appeared a gleaming white doorway that slowly opened onto a place of beauty and peace. I'm not sure if it was real or if I'm just remembering it that way, but it seemed as if a summer breeze washed over me, warm and heavy with the scent of blossom and freshly cut grass. And there, amid the trees and flowers, stood my father, just as I remembered him as a wee boy. He reached out his hand to me, smiling that welcoming smile of his, and... but someone was calling me.
Help us, Carson! Help us!
Taylor? Startled, I turned around, and the portal sizzled shut behind me.
Perhaps you're not quite ready yet, Dr. Beckett.
I thought I heard Taylor.
An echo. A memory. Sometimes it's difficult to let go. You have a little time before the portal collapses. Perhaps you should use it to say a final goodbye to your friends.
When I remember those hours, I walked Atlantis's beautiful halls and corridors. I'm struck by a mixture of melancholy and huge pride. I remember watching the people going about their business, friends and colleagues, all of them, and hardly being able to comprehend that this was no longer my world. Each detail seemed precious, from the bad coffee in the cafeteria to the impossible beauty of Atlantis' spires. And I remember thinking that Gilbert was right. I didn't want to let go. In fact, it was the last thing I wanted to do. But just then, I didn't believe I had a choice. And so I walked on, seeking out those who would be the hardest to leave. Perhaps that's why it took me so long to get there, because it was the coldest, bleakest hour of the night by the time I found Rodney in his lab, muttering to himself as he worked. He looked exhausted and over-caffeinated, dark rings heavy beneath his eyes as he stared at his computer. Zelenka was just as dishevelled, unshaven and edgy. And all around I could feel the rising tide of panic, like the fearful inhabitants of a medieval plague village. No one knew who would be struck down next. How could I leave them like this? How could I just walk away? But I knew I couldn't stay. How could I, when I was no more than a shade haunting the shadows of the city? I think at that point, I would have been ready to go. If the portal had opened just then and I'd seen my father waiting, felt the fragrant breeze, I would have stepped through into the world beyond. Perhaps that's why I was heading back to the infirmary, in order to find Dr. Gilbert, in order to do the very thing she wanted. But just then, as I reached the doorway, I stopped dead. There it is. The shadow I glimpsed in the residential quarters was back inside the infirmary. A grey, amorphous shape. It flickered like a dull flame as it floated through the room. And silently, I followed. Then, when it reached Dr. Weir's bed, it stopped. It hovered over her, just an inch or so from her body. And I remember feeling cold with dread because the shadow looked like death. Suddenly, Dr. Weir gasped, her back arching as if something was being ripped from her chest. Elizabeth! I rushed forward and the shadow streaked away, shrieking as it disappeared into the walls. Quickly, I checked Dr. Weir's vitals. They were worse, much worse. There was no doubt in my mind now. This shadow, this miasma, was causing the sickness, and it had to be stopped.
But not by you, Carson.
Startled, I spun around to find Dr. Gilbert watching me with a small, sad smile. Did you see it?
There's no role for you here now, in the land of the living. You must move on. Look.
Again, she lifted her hand and opened the portal. And this time it showed a place of such aching familiarity. I thought my heart might break. That was the intention, I suppose, to bait the hook with something irresistible. That was why she showed me my home, my childhood home with my father, smiling at the front gate.
He's waiting for you. It's been so long, Carson. It's time to go home.
And that was when I made my decision. Again, I don't know if what happened was real. I suppose there's so much of this that doesn't seem real that I've given up trying to sort it out in my mind. But what matters is that as I looked at him, at my father's familiar face, I heard his voice as clear as day. Now, son, you'll be finishing what you started or you'll not be having your tea. I remember an enormous sense of peace descending on me at that moment, as if I suddenly saw the path ahead of me and I knew what I had to do. I was still smiling at the memory when I turned to Dr. Gilbert and said, I can't leave my friends like this. I'm the only one who's seen the shadow, the only one who knows what's happening.
Have a care, Dr. Beckett. Don't look for reasons to linger, to postpone the acceptance of the truth, for your future lies beyond now, with your family. Your friends will find a way without you.
Looking back, I could see that she was angry. But she hid it well and pressed on with her attempts to persuade me to leave. Of course she did, because she knew exactly what to say.
Don't risk eternity, Carson. Don't allow yourself to become an unquiet spirit, cut off forever from the glory of the afterlife because you refuse to leave this paltry, transient existence. Your despair, I assure you, would be complete and unending. There's no need to fear, Carson, for what is to come is glorious beyond your imagining.
Maybe so, but I'll not leave this business unfinished. At the very least, I must warn them.
Impossible. They cannot see or...
Taylor can. She spoke to me while she was meditating. I have to try to warn her, warn them all. A flicker of surprise crossed her face, gone almost before I'd noticed. It wasn't enough to alert me, though, to what was about to happen. Although by now it was very late at night, I hurried straight to Taylor's quarters. The corridors were silent, everyone afraid behind their closed doors, and I passed no one on my way. It was as if the city had been abandoned again, as if I were the last soul left alive. Soon enough, I reached Taylor's room, but I hesitated a moment before entering, and I remember feeling strangely awkward about not knocking. Not that I could knock, of course, but even so it seemed rude to just barge in it. It's funny, isn't it, how even at the most precarious of times, these little things can bother you. But needs must, of course. And I probably only hesitated a moment or two before taking a deep breath and stepping through into her quarters. What greeted me there froze me to the bone. The thing, the shadow, was hovering over Taylor's sleeping body.
No! Get away from her! I grabbed the nearest thing to hand, one of Taylor's Eskrima sticks, and swung at the creature. I was in a rage, not thinking clearly, and my weapon went right through the thing, but at least I got its attention, and it turned towards me. I could see no eyes, no features in the grey swirl of its face, but I could sense a terrible rage, a terrible hunger. What? What are you? Suddenly the creature leaped towards me, and to my horror I felt cold, bony fingers tightening about my neck. I grappled with it, but it was like fighting air. Insubstantial fingers tore at me and were gone. I was flung to the floor by a force of huge power, but I had no mass, no substance. And then, from the midst of the swirling grey mist, I saw a face congeal. Ghostly and shifting, but a face nonetheless. The face of a wraith.
You have no place here, dead man. This feeding ground is mine.
And then it was gone, and I was left gasping for breath on the floor. Shaken, I climbed to my feet. Taylor was still asleep, but her face was pale and clammy. Her pulse fluttered quickly beneath my fingers. Desperate to wake her, I sat on the edge of the bed and put my hands on either side of her face. She'd seen me twice, and both times she'd been deep in meditation. Perhaps while she was sleeping, I could contact her again. Taylor, can you hear me, love? This isn't a dream. You need to listen to me, all right? There's a wraith in Atlantis. Well, not a wraith, a shadow of a wraith. I can't explain it, but it's the cause of the sleeping sickness. It's feeding. It's feeding on you all. Suddenly, she jolted awake. Carson! She put her hand to her chest as if she could feel the touch of the shadow and whispered, "A wraith?" Then leaping from her bed, she bolted out the door. The thing I remember about racing through the city after Taylor was that dawn was just breaking and the early morning sunlight was casting Atlantis in the most beautiful shades of silver and blue. And it seemed to me that it was a sign of hope, and I felt quite optimistic as we ran towards the commissary. She knew as well as I did that it's where everyone would be, and it was a good guess because Rodney and Zelenka were both there, Ronan hovering in the shadows as if he didn't know how else to help. I understood how he felt as I drifted in after Taylor, ghosting the edges of the room and unable to do anything but listen to her breathless explanation. "I saw Dr. Beckett," she said. "He spoke to me." I could tell from the outset that Rodney didn't believe a word of it. "I stopped believing in ghosts about 30 Halloweens ago," he told her snippetly. But Taylor was undaunted. "Not a ghost," she said. "He's not dead." There was an awkward pause while Rodney busied himself stirring his coffee. "No brain activity generally means death, Taylor. I'm sorry, but there's no point in hoping that..." She cut him off mid-flow. "He told me there's a wraith here." Rodney scoffed. "A wraith? Do you have any idea how Atlantis responds if a wraith enters orbit? I hardly think
She put her hand on his arm, stopping him and drawing his attention from the coffee to her face. Dr. McKay, what if he did come back? And what if he brought something worse than a virus with him? Rodney stared at her for a moment, then leaped to his feet in apparent triumph. A wraith! Of course! That's it! The symptoms without the physical cause because it doesn't exist in the same physical plane. I can't believe I didn't... Wait, are you saying Carson brought something back with him from the Wraith Hell dimension? Oh, this could be bad, Rodney said. This could be very bad indeed. I remember that for a moment. I couldn't move, as if even the slightest motion would have confirmed the truth somehow. A Wraith Hell dimension. Is that where I've been? Or is that where I still am? Suddenly, I was back there. The howling wind, the icy cold, annoying, endless hunger. And that's when I remembered. That's when I remembered everything. An ancient laboratory, dark and grim, long abandoned. But Rodney's excitement had seemed to light the gloomy lab. Interdimensional travel, so he thought. But he was wrong. It was something else. The ancients at their worst. They created a weapon that slashed the very fabric of the universe and banished its victims to an eternity of suffering. It sent them to a hell of endless hunger and desolation. Too cruel a fate even for the Wraith. I remember how our fascination dissolved into disgust. I remember turning away from the device and then... A gash in space-time, writhing and crackling, and through it, ghostly hands clutched at me, dragging me through the fracture, desperate for a life to feed upon. Anything to ease their incessant hunger. Colonel Shepard raced towards me, yelling, but I couldn't hear him above the howl of the wind. His arms stretched out as to grab me, but he was too far away, and the biting fingers were hauling me through too fast, relentless in their desperation. And something started forcing itself inside my head, into my mind, and I was screaming and screaming, and Shepard didn't make it because it was too far. It was too late. Help me!
Carson.
What?
Carson. Time's running out. The portal cannot linger.
I remember. It was an ancient outpost, a lab of some kind. We thought it was a medical lab, but then Rodney said that they'd been working on interdimensional travel. He was excited and...
If you don't leave now, Carson, you'll be trapped forever.
We triggered something, a weapon, and there was this gash, like lightning, and they dragged me through. They dragged me through, and Colonel Shepard was running and...
Is this what you want? To haunt these halls and corridors for eternity, unable to do anything but watch?
I don't care. I don't care, don't you understand? I don't care about that. There's a wraith here. Somehow, they must have brought me back from that place. And this thing came with me. It's killing them. And I'm the only one who can fight it. The only one who can help them. I pushed past her, hurrying after Rodney, who was already marching towards his lab, deep in conversation with Zelenka. And it was while they considered various ways to destroy the wraith that a thought occurred to me. If they killed it, then how would that help its victims? How would it help Dr. Weir or Colonel Shepard and all the others who'd been fed upon? We knew that the Wraith could give life as well as take it. And I realised that it wasn't enough to destroy this Wraith. It had to be forced to give back the life it had stolen. The question was, how? I pondered the question as I wandered Atlantis, eventually finding myself back in the infirmary. The isolation room in which my body lay. Gilbert was there too, sitting on the edge of the bed, hands folded in her lap. She looked up as I entered.
It won't be long now.
I knew what she meant. My vitals were low, the body beginning to give up the fight. Death lurked in the shadows, close and inevitable.
Time's running out.
There has to be a way to reverse the effects of the Wraith feeding, a way to save these people.
If there is, it's none of your concern. Trust your friends, Carson. This is not your fight.
But it is! I touched the Wraith. I'm the only one who...
Enough!
She got to her feet, angry now, and with a slashing motion opened the portal again.
Go. Now. There's no more time.
Again, I could see my father, waiting for me in an endless summer of golden memories. He smiled, arms open.
Go! It's time to go home, Carson.
But my friends...
All things must pass. And your time here is over. Your friends must walk their own path without you, just as you must walk yours. Go. Go now. before it's too late.
Behind me, I could hear the slow beep of the heart monitor. Could feel the life fading from my body. And I remember thinking that perhaps she was right. Of course, I know now that she was just reflecting my own doubts and fears back to me. She was feeding my sense that it was nothing but hubris that kept me hanging on. That it was ridiculous to imagine that I, and I alone, could solve the problem and save the day. Were there not other doctors? Better doctors? Rodney, Taylor, all the others. They could handle anything, couldn't they? And deep down, didn't I know that Atlantis would carry on without me? I didn't turn around. Didn't look back as I stepped forward. My father smiled, warm and gentle, as I reached out. It was Rodney and his team, Ronan, Taylor and security detail right behind them. "It's in here," Rodney was saying, steadying a device he held in his hand. "Right there." He pointed straight at Gilbert, and on the threshold of the portal I stopped.
"Hurry, Carson, quickly."
The portal was beginning to close, my father fading.
"This is your last chance, go."
She pushed me, shoving me towards the portal, pushing me into it. "Wait, wait, what are you?"
"Leave this place."
"Who are you?" Rodan opened fire, a dazzling arc of blue flames that blasted us both across the room. We landed in a tangled heap, but as I struggled away from her, I could see that she was changing. Writhing on the floor, the woman that I had known as Dr. Gilbert slowly transformed. Her face twisted, her limbs, hands, everything contorting into the grotesque mask of a wraith. And suddenly, I understood. The portal was no gateway to the afterlife, no doorway to heaven. It was the mouth of hell, the entrance to the dreadful place from which the wraith had escaped and to which it must be returned. In the distance, I could hear Rodney yelling, "Did you hit it? It's moving again." But I paid him no mind. All my attention was fixed on the wraith. I lunged before it had time to find its feet, but it was strong, fast, and it leaped away, pouncing onto the comatose body that lay in the bed. My body. But it wasn't feeding. It shimmered, as if passing in and out of existence, and I heard Taylor gasp. "What's happening to him?" My body was changing, lips peeling back to reveal inhuman teeth, the fingers of my hands growing longer, claw-like. And suddenly, I knew. This was what it wanted. This was why it tried so hard to send me back to its hellish dimension. It was trying to possess my body, and by doing so, it would fully enter our reality.
"No, leave! Dead man! This body, this feeding ground is mine now!"
"Oh, I don't think so. Not while I'm still here. That's why you are so keen to send me back to dear old Dad. So keen for me to embrace my own death. Because while I'm here, while I'm still alive, you cannot enter."
"You are weak. You are human. And I will have your body. I will taste the sweetness of human life again."
"I don't think so." I remember watching my body fucking contort, knowing somehow, just knowing that this creature had been in my head from the moment I returned from the hellish place. Two consciousnesses fighting for the same body, for the same entryway to our reality. And I knew that if I gave up, if I let it possess me, that I'd be dooming more than just Atlantis. I'd be dooming Earth and every planet in our galaxy. With a determination born of terror and panic, I yanked the creature off my body, hauling it to the floor. Desperately, it launched itself at me, and behind me I heard the crackle and hiss of the portal opening. Slowly, the wraith pushed me towards it.
"What is hunger to you? Nothing. You do not hunger like the rest. You do not know our torment. I will not return."
"Well, you can't stay. I'll not allow it."
"You are weak. You are human. You can't..."
"Aye, but I have friends." As the creature lay writhing in pain, I hauled her upright and thrust her into the portal.
"No! I won't go back! I won't!"
"Give them back what you stole!"
"No!
Give them back their lives!"
"Please!"
"There's no room for life in that place! Give it back!"
"No!"
But even as she screamed, I could see a mist rise from her thrashing body. Life. The life she's stolen from the people of Atlantis. Because not a breath of life could exist in the hell beyond. Half trapped in the portal, she flailed and screamed, and I knew there were cold, ghostly fingers dragging her back. I felt pity then, despite all she had done to my friends. To me, because I knew the horror of that vast, endless wasteland. I knew the hunger, the thirst, the desolation to which the ancients had condemned her, to which I was returning her.
Help me!
And for that moment, it wasn't a wraith. It was Dr. Gilbert again, tears washing her cheeks as she reached out pleading hands.
Doctor, please! Help me! Help me!
But I didn't. I couldn't.
Please, I will not be banished!
I will not be!
And as I watched, the portal folded in upon itself. She was gone. And then there was silence. And then darkness. And then nothing. For a long time, I drifted in dark. I felt nothing, neither heat nor cold, pain nor hunger. I was alone. Then I heard a whisper flitting through the silence, and another, louder, voices familiar but indistinct.
Any change?
He has more colour. Dr. Weir? Colonel Shepherd? I felt strange, suddenly heavy, my leg throbbing badly and a sour taste in my mouth. My eyes flickered open for a moment, but it was too bright. He's waking up. Was that Rodney's voice? Someone took my hand, soft skin warm against my fingers. Again, I opened my eyes and peered through foggy vision to see a face smiling at me. Taylor. Welcome back, Carson, she said softly, squeezing my hand. We missed you. I smiled as best I could. I've been right here, I assured her. I've been right here all the time, love. I don't think much about it now, about Dr. Gilbert, about the Wraith, and how I condemned her to so much suffering. I had no choice after all. But I've come to realise that in a way, the woman I knew as Dr. Gilbert was a part of me. The Wraith used my own memories, my thoughts, my feelings to construct her. And sometimes I wonder if part of me isn't still there, in that Wraith hell. But like I said, I don't think about it too often. Life here on Atlantis is too busy for self-indulgence. There was one day though, a few weeks after it happened, when I found myself standing on one of the city's balconies. It was the same balcony on which I encountered Taylor the night it all began, and as I stood there staring out at the vast emptiness of the sea, I closed my eyes. For a moment, I allowed the image of Dr. Gilbert to float before me. We, none of us, know what lies beyond, but standing there in the midst of the eternal ocean, I felt I'd been granted a glimpse of what may come. I can't know for certain if the Halcyon Gardens where my father waits is real, but I chose to believe it, and I chose to believe that whatever part of me became Dr. Gilbert is waiting there too, with my father, for the day when I complete my journey to that undiscovered country. After a while, I opened my eyes. Bright sunshine glittered on the waves, and I turned away from it, back to Atlantis, back to my duties, and back to my life.
Sitting here with Paul McGillian in his trailer on the set of Atlantis for season 5.
Hello.
And we're going to talk a little bit about the recording of Perchance to Dream, which was the first play that you did for us.
Yes.
Had you done an audio play before?
I have, yes. But that, you know, not nearly as good as this one, though.
But this was playing an established character that you knew inside out. How did that change things for you?
it changed things a lot because you do know the character a lot. But, you know, it's interesting because it's just you talking the entire time. So it's a lot of Beckett, you know, a lot of Beckett. But I really, you know, I really enjoyed it. It was challenging because you really have to go to, you know, this episode, you know, Beckett's being tortured basically at times, you know, tormented, and you really have to put it out there because the difference is, you know, on camera you can see the physical, but with an audio tape it's just the vocal performance that you have to deal with, and so you really have to go there. So I apologize of being a bit of a nutter in the booth, so to speak, but you know, you have to go for it. But it was really interesting and challenging for sure.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned then that, you know, one of the differences between audio and visual is that you can obviously reacting with your face, not just your voice, but with radio you can only use your voice. How does that affect how you prepare?
Well, I think you have to. It doesn't make too much of a difference to me because I think you have to look at it and fully commit yourself to it as you would on camera performance as well. I'd like to hope I would anyway. And I think, you know, acting is all about commitment, and you have to fully commit to it either way. Or, you know, and I think the interesting with the people, it would be very easy for someone to listen to something, and if people aren't committed, you can kind of tell because that's all you have is the listening aspect of it. So if someone's not committed to it in a performance level, you don't go on that journey with them. Mm-hmm. So I really wanted to make sure that I was believable in the situation that I was put in, the writer put me in. And it was challenging, but I think you have to go to that place to make it believable for the audience. And then the great thing about it is that they can go on that journey and use their imagination to visualize the surroundings and the situation. And that's the great thing about it. And also, hopefully, people that, you know, don't watch Atlantis will be able to listen to the audiobook and go on a ride as well.
In some ways, it's a classic sci-fi story. It's all about perception and what's beyond the veil that we don't know about. When you first read the script, what were your thoughts about it?
I thought it was very interesting when I first read the script. You're exactly right. I thought, you know, it taps into, you know, your fears, what everyone's fears are, what their understanding of the worst possible situations that could happen to their friends, and it kind of it reminded me of another episode of Atlantis we did one time called Phantoms a little bit. It had, you know, it kind of had that feel for me where you know, whatever your worst fear is, it will come true. And I think it just had the same emotional feel to me, and that's interesting because that's a Carl Binder script, and he writes very similar to what Sally did as well, you know. And I felt that the humanity of the character was really drawn out, and I often feel that about Carl's scripts as well. So and it was very easy for me to tap into that. I thought it was very challenging and interesting, and it was a draining emotional journey as an actor to do it.
It's interesting because obviously usually when you're acting on Atlantis, you're with everyone else, you're with the rest of the cast, but here it's just you, and you were, at points you were doing great impressions of McKay and things like that. How did you find that?
Well, it's good because they kind of get in my way usually anyway, so... Yeah. David talks way too much. It's almost daunting at first when you get the script and it's like every page you turn, it's a monologue, Beckett monologue, monologue, monologue. So you're like, okay, here we go. You know, it's very different where you don't have anybody else to play off. That's why I said you really have to kind of map out your emotional journey, and hopefully you're interesting, you know, enough to carry a full audio play like that. You know, hopefully it works out.
You also had to sustain the accent, which I know you've said before isn't a problem for you, but to me, listening to you do the Scottish accent all the way through, it's amazing to hear.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I know, it's, you know, I love the accent, and it's really, I have no problem popping back and forth between, you know, my regular speaking voice and Beckett, no problem whatsoever. I mean, I just love the character, and it's so easy. My parents have thick Scottish accents, and so thankfully, I don't have to think a whole lot about it. I mean, because that could be a whole world of problems right there if I did. It's a kind of thing where it's a real pleasure. I mean, sometimes you have to take a look at paragraphs and really kind of plot out the certain words that, you know, enunciation-wise, and you have to take a look at. But it is challenging. I'm not going to lie to you. It was a challenging exercise, but I think it's a really good exercise. I think every actor should have it, you know, should have a kick at it if they have the opportunity. I strongly recommend it because, I mean, that's a workout. It really is. It's an emotional workout. It's a vocal workout. And as an actor, you really, you know, you have to put yourself right in there. You know, I've been fortunate enough to have done quite a bit of radio voiceover work in cartoons and things like that. So I've had experience in the sound booth before. But I tell you, it's a challenging thing.
Because half of acting is reacting, really, isn't it? So
yeah, listening and reacting. Mm. And you know, in this one, you're just, you really have to use your imagination, put yourself in the place, and hopefully it's the same place that, the listeners are going to be as well. You'll have to let me know how it goes. I think, you know, I was, you know, thank God for those special effects that you put in there, and the music and everything, and the, you know, the reverb. No, I really hope that, I hope the fans enjoy it. And like I said, I think it can reach outside of the Stargate world as well. And I think the fans that do like Stargate and will hopefully get a real kick out of it, because I think it's a great journey for Beckett, and it was certainly a pleasure to do it. And, you know, I thank you anytime.
Thank you,
Sharon. She's lovely, by the way.